From 20th Century Fox comes Screen Dive, the first podcast developed and produced by a major Hollywood studio. And I've just always wanted to do that voice for anything related to the movies, to be that preview guy. But I will continue in my own normal voice because, you know, I kind of felt like I sounded stupid there. Screen Dive re-examined some of our most beloved films through new interviews and behind-the-scenes insights with the artists who brought them to life. Guests explore iconic titles like The Sandlot, Planet of the Apes, Deadpool, and The Devil Wears Prada. Listen to Screen Dive on October 30th on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, YouTube, or wherever else you like to listen. So let's talk a little Bucks Celtics here. We did this for the NBA cast today, our first time on Twitch. Follow me on Twitch at twitch.tv/NateDuncanNBA, a better platform. We're working through some of the tech issues. We just basically got it up and running like 30 minutes before we were able to start, since we've been pretty busy watching games and doing other stuff. But hopefully we'll continue to evolve there. The chat was great. Really enjoyed it. I think we're going to even be able to have some options for streamers to sync up that'll be a little bit more reliable than what we had with Periscope. So we'll still be doing Periscope the next few times, but we're going to transition solely into doing it on Twitch over the next week or so. I'm sorry, next month or so, I should say. But overall impressions here, Bucks, Celtics.
The thousand-mile view of this for me is a kind of an important takeaway, but not one that was necessarily surprising for the two of us, which is Mike Budenholzer is miles better as a coach, as a tactician, than Jason Kidd.
Or Joe Prunty,
however,
for that matter. Or at least to be sure. Fair, Joe Prunty without a...
coaching Jason Kidd's...
Yeah. Yeah, but also, I mean, Joe had his own foibles in the rotation, to be sure.
Oh, yes, he did. And so you have that, and it has been a very important part of Milwaukee's surge this season to a 7-0 start, now 7-1. However, you and I have done playoff games that Mike Budenholzer has coached. We have watched a lot of Mike Budenholzer's team's games. And while a substantial improvement, he has his own flaws, and those flaws are far more concerning against the best of the best than they are against everybody else. But this game put those in stark relief for me in a couple of big ways. The end of the game is one that we'll talk about a lot, but then also earlier in the game, just some of the general defensive tactics against the Celtics were just so easy to exploit.
Yeah, they were. And the Celtics, I forget what the NBA record is now. It falls like once a week, so I should probably remember this a little bit better, but 24 of 55 of their 92 shots were three-pointers. Now they only shot 46% on two-pointers and didn't really get to the foul line much. You know, there were some intentional fouls late that inflated that. So, I mean, if you take away the three-pointers, they actually did a really good job of defending the Celtics. But when you give up 55 three-point attempts and they make 44% of them, and this is a team that can get that hot, you're not going to have a very good defensive game. And this is a Celtics offense that has largely struggled coming in, although Kyrie Irving certainly looked a lot better in these last couple of games. So maybe that's going to be in the rearview mirror. But yeah, go ahead.
Well, so can I make a point? So a point on that, first of all, you're right to bring up the number of three-pointers. But for me, it was the clarity and the simplicity,
yes,
that for those three-pointers that is the big problem. You can, you know, if a team jacks up 55 threes, that's fine. But especially in the beginning of the game, and then at the beginning of the third quarter when Brook Lopez was in, all Boston had to do to get one branch of easy three was set a high pick and roll with Brook Lopez's guy. And Lopez would stay, I don't know, 10 feet away from that action, protecting the paint, and then either Al Horford or the initiator of the pick and roll would be wide open. A lot of times that was Horford. He ended up 4 for 11 on threes, and I, off the top of my head, 10 of those 11 were wide open, something like that. And Al Horford's a 40% free throw shooter, 3-point shooter. So yeah, he's gonna make a bunch of those. And then you can talk about the second variant of it, which we saw the Celtics absolutely eviscerate the Bucks with in the second half.
Yeah, in particular the third quarter, where all you have to do is drive into the free throw line, and not even necessarily, you know, a blow by here, but someone would come in, help from the opposite wing to the nail, and then they'd just throw it to the guy for a three-pointer. And it really got crazy in that third quarter with the threes. You could tell that Boston was able to look on film at what the Bucks were doing. They were really bringing a ton of help. Ilyasova, a very good help defender, he probably even is helping more than he ever did in Philly under Bud's system.
And that has worked against a lot of teams. I mean, the Bucks are the number two defense coming in, although as you noted on the broadcast, part of that is that opponents are only shooting 30% on threes, and they're giving up a fair number of threes still. And Bud's teams have always given up a fair number of threes, as we saw when Cleveland set, you know, another playoff record for three-pointers against Bud's Hawks in, I believe it was 2016. So really, they did a great job of cutting off the rim. Like, I think they only had four shots at the rim in the first half, and what were they for the game?
7 for 11.
Yeah, I mean, that's the fewest number of shots at the rim I can ever remember. I don't have a way that I know of to actually check that, but that wouldn't surprise me if that's, like, you know, one of the lowest figures in a game that, like, maybe we've even ever seen. So maybe what he would tell you is, you know what? Yeah, we gave up a lot of threes, but we forced a fair amount of long twos. Now, when they're taking 55 of their 92 shots as threes, there's not that many long twos left to take, but we cut off the rim and they didn't get to the foul line on us at all, though this is in a high free throw team. And you mentioned the pick and pop as being the other way, but so there's that aspect of it that they just really helped so much. And this is a Boston team too that, you know, was very happy to settle for mid-range jumpers, you know. And I think Stevens went in at halftime and was like, hey, guys are open, stop settling for mid-range jumpers, just act like you're gonna drive, they're gonna overhelp, we'll get some threes. But the next part of it too is that with Al Horford playing center for the Celtics in particular, the Bucks, for all of the changes that they've made, the new personnel, they looked much better in a lot of ways, especially on offense, than they did in that series a year ago. But and what you got to consider too, that, you know, Kyrie didn't play in that series, and neither did Gordon Hayward, who was good tonight. So they clearly have elevated their levels. You know, the Bucks almost certainly would have beaten last year's Celtics team tonight, the way they're playing. But at center, they still don't have the personnel to match up with Horford and the pick and pop game. And you'll recall during that playoff series that Thonmaker, when they exhumed him for game three, it was either Thonmaker or Giannis was the only time that they could play well in that series if they had either of those guys at center. And of course, you know, what sunk them in game seven was going to Tyler Zeller, now out of the league. And so I do think that still Brook Lopez, maybe he can play when Baines is on the floor, but, you know, he's the starting center, and so he has to match up with Al Horford at the beginning. And, you know, it's a regular season game, maybe you don't want to change your starting lineup, but I mean, if these teams match up in the playoffs and they wait until game three to not start Brook Lopez, like, they're going to lose the series probably. But yeah, that's about all I've got on the scheme thing. Was there anything else you wanted to add there?
Well, I'll mention that Milwaukee went from 30.1 opponent three-point percentage to 33.1 just on this game. And right now, the Bucks are giving up the third highest three-point attempt proportion of possessions. They are giving up the fewest shots to the rim, so this game really does confirm all that. But, I mean, if you're giving up that many threes with the capable shooters that are out there, and especially, I mean, they don't always have to be as open as they were in this game. But I want to go back to a point that you brought up, which is that the Celtics, not only do they have a lot of guys that settle for mid-range shots, they have a lot of guys that you don't need to panic and help on. If there's a drive from Terry Rozier and he's getting in the paint, probably the most devastating thing he can do most of the time is make a pass for an open three. That is the best offensive outcome that comes from that, because if he takes a free throw line jumper, or that has a lower expected value than an open three. So trust in your defenders. They have a lot of length, they have a lot of skill to not necessarily make every play, because nobody makes every play, but to make the play harder than what your help is accomplishing.
Yeah, and, you know, we'll see. I mean, this was one game. They were close. Although I will say that if the Celtics hadn't just missed a ton of wide open threes in the last few minutes of the game, this game wouldn't have been close. You know, I mean, it was to get down to one possession. We'll talk about the end of the game as well. From Boston's standpoint, they did struggle to defend the Bucks a lot more than they did in the playoffs last year. Although I will say that Kyrie Irving made some pretty good plays. He had two block shots in this game. He was, like, coming over and helping and, like, trying to actually jump and bother people at the rim. Another indication that even if you're a small guy, if you actually, like, get there and jump, you can still affect people at the rim. But the Bucks looked a lot better offensively. They shot it poorly from downtown, only 9 out of 29. Although, ironically, it was they who came in leading, or maybe they're second in the league behind Houston in percentage of shots as three-pointers. And Boston really did kind of shut those down. That enabled Giannis to totally go off for 33 points, 13 of 22 from the field. Got to the foul line for 7 of 11. I wish he could have made a few more of those free throws. And so I think that Giannis really benefited from the additional space. I mean, the Bucks had Lopez, who obviously is a spacer now. John Henson, who has been shooting the three ball well, he hit an above the break three. I mean, I thought he was just going to be, like, shooting from the corners. No, he's actually being aggressive above the break and hitting him, which is funny because he wasn't even really ever shooting mid-rangers before this. And then they bring out Ilyasova to play some at center. He's like kind of the mobile center, but not really that mobile. He's just smart. So they did space the floor really well, and Boston was, in marked contrast to the Bucks' theory, decided that they were going to stay home. You know, maybe Giannis was going to brutalize them on occasion. They tried to help where they could, but they weren't going to give up open threes. They weren't going to let Chris Middleton just kill them, and he was 3 of 10 from 3. He got some shots up, but very few of those were uncontested. And they did a good job of taking away threes from some of the Bucks support players. Definitely a big time contrast in styles defensively in this game.
We're really early on. I mean, we're in the first 10 games for each of these teams, and a playoff series could look very different, but those approaches were striking. And Milwaukee, I mean, as much as they're like, I think they have a lot more low hanging fruit coming away from this game. And granted, it shouldn't have been as close as it was. I mean, this was a 10-point game for most of the second half, yeah. But then, well, yeah. And then it kicked back in, and Middleton. So the low hanging fruit is the defensive part, which we talked about. And then also, like, I would say there were a few guys on the Bucks that had worse than expected games in ways that you wouldn't necessarily expect to see repeat. So yes, Boston did a nice job defending Chris Middleton, and a lot of different guys deserve credit for being on him, for not really giving him much space. But he was, I think he was something like 3 of 13 for a lot of this game, and then he got a little bit hot late and made a few shots, got a couple of threes. I think he was like 1 for 8 on threes originally, and all of it counts, obviously. And Bledsoe had a hit or miss night on both ends of the floor. Like, he had a few possessions where he looked great, and then he had a few possessions where you're wondering what the heck is going on. And I like that you brought up Kyrie Irving's defense, because there's a line of just, you know, doing something more affirmatively positive, like a block or being in the right place to force a turnover or something like that. But the other thing that was notable about Kyrie Irving's defensive game for me was how little he was victimized. There were a few times where he got caught on Giannis and then they would either send a double or a foul or something like that. But those plays were pretty rare. And I also thought that, generally speaking, having Ojeleye in the starting lineup because Jaylen Brown was unavailable in this game, it worked out reasonably well, just because Ojeleye is so strong that Giannis couldn't move him as much. But then even over time, Giannis was able to figure out how to take advantage of the new rules, and Ojeleye maybe wasn't as crisp. So he still did fine. But I mean, it is remarkable to see the growth in Giannis's game, but also that Ojeleye is one of these guys who, he's not an amazing, you know, basketball player. I mean, obviously by any NBA standards, he'd be amazing in any other league. But he can do a good job of making life hard on guys who do not usually get life made hard on them.
Yeah, that's a good point. And Ojeleye also 2 of 4 from 3, which was encouraging here. And he hadn't been playing much.
Yeah, and in that early part of the game, he was the only guy on the Celtics that was making threes. Yeah. Horford was getting all these wide open ones. That was before Irving really got going, which he did, I believe, in the second and third quarter. Third quarter, he was masterful. And yeah, I mean, Ojeleye, he had those big shots. He only played 22 minutes in this game, but I thought he did a nice job. And he's a different type of player than Marcus Smart. I think he brings less to the table, but also takes less away, which is pretty interesting. One other thing I want to talk about, you alluded to it before, but I want to give some of the stats on this. Boston's third quarter. So the Celtics were 8 of 14 from 3 and 5 of 10 from 2 in the quarter. So they took more twos than more threes than twos, and made more of them, similar proportion, of course. And they only turned the ball over one time. So that's another way that the Bucks' help was not producing dividends. So they weren't forcing turnovers. And so it was a 38-25 quarter, and that just really swung this game. And Milwaukee cut it close late, but it was mostly just strange defensive execution and Boston knowing exactly how to attack.
And speaking of knowing exactly how to attack, last 5 minutes or so with Ilyasova in the game, they decided they're going to change up to pick and roll coverage because Horford was just getting wide open and pick and pop every time. So what they decide they're going to do is bring the big, maybe not quite a hard trap, but up to the level of the ball, double team, and then if they threw it back to the pop man, bring over the weak side wing to not just stunt at the guy and get back, but actually to really just pick him up. And so Boston, they did this against the Bucks in the regular season last year. I think it was the second time that these teams played in Boston in particular, that what you do there, and they had Smart on the floor, so they felt like, okay, we'll leave Smart. Well, what they did is they would swing the ball to Horford. Middleton, usually on the weak side wing, would come over to take Horford. And then you got basically a 2-on-1 on the weak side. And so Smart would just set a flare screen for Kyrie Irving, and they would just swing it to the opposite corner to Irving, and he got like a couple of threes. Or I think one of them might have been Hayward as well. And they were just able to get a wide open corner three on the backside with that. I think it was like at least three times that works. So ultimately, I think they're going to have to do some switching. I think that Boston, until further notice, is somewhat switchable. I think that the Bucks have enough length, maybe, that you can go to that strategy with Giannis. But I guess maybe the only reason not to do that is if you're not going to play Maker at all, and he looks to be buried at the moment. He played some four in their win when Giannis was unavailable against the Raptors and actually played pretty well. But if he's going to be buried, if you're going to play Giannis at center, now you've got Middleton at the four. I guess maybe you got Snell at the three, or maybe it's Brogdon, and you bring DiVincenzo in, who looked pretty good today. Bledsoe. So those guys are a little bit small at every position, you know, which is kind of a problem. But it's better than I think what they were giving up here. And the Celtics were just so smart at attacking what they were doing. And so once again, I was struck by, this is something I talked about on Anthony Slater's podcast last night, All 82, that there are four teams, if Houston is right, which, you know, hopefully they will get there, that could play switching defense, that have enough creators to draw help or pass against a switching defense, and then enough shooting that you can't just like completely load the floor up. And that's Boston, Toronto, Golden State, and Houston. And after watching this defensive performance from the Bucks, I can't put them into that category yet, even if they did show some encouraging signs in this game and they kept it close for a while. It just never seemed like they quite were there.
I wonder if and how the rotation is going to look different when we get to the later stages. And this Bucks team is good enough that I expect them to at least get a better seed and have an opportunity. And DiVincenzo is a fascinating part of that. He did only go 1-for-4 on threes, but he looks totally comfortable taking them. And I was actually really impressed. The biggest takeaway for me from him in this game was actually his finishing. He had one really nice one where Marcus Smart hit him on the drive and he finished with his left hand. And then the other one, so when a guy has a jump shot the teams have to respect, I use the phrase two dribbles in a good decision a lot, where it's just basically, can you create separation and can you do something with it? That might not be taking a pull up two. Maybe you can't get all the way to the rack. Maybe you find a guy, something else like that. And he had a couple plays that looked in the kind of proto stages of what that would look like. And I mean, he's a guy who played a lot of guard and had the ball in his hands a fair amount from what I saw at Nova. So it wouldn't surprise me if he has that in his game. I didn't watch much of his tape, so I don't know this for sure. And if he can get to that stage, whether it's this year or next year, it's a very useful player, especially when the guy that he's at least conceptually competing with for an unmarked spot in this potentially starting lineup or closing lineup or however we want to define it is Malcolm Brogdon, who despite his gifts has problems making that, like, okay, I need to do this right now, get to a place, and then the defense will react to me. He does make good plays, but he doesn't.
He's a very slow decision maker, Brogdon.
Yeah, he's kind of like the point guard version of Ibaka, where it's not necessarily that he'll make a bad decision, he just won't make a good decision quickly enough. Yeah,
but he can still, I mean, he had some beautiful left-handed drives in this game.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd like to see him bomb threes more. And getting back to DiVincenzo, wonderful rebounder, man. That guy gets off the floor on the defensive glass. He's already got 29 rebounds this year in eight games, playing about 20 minutes a game. Well, we got to watch his three-point percentage. He definitely shoots it like he could make it. He takes some pretty difficult ones, but he's 9 out of 31 on the year. That's under 30%. So let's watch that. Obviously, not the biggest sample in the world, but you know, if he continues to shoot under 30% on threes, maybe it'll take him a while to get there. Any other observations? I mean, I guess we should talk about Gordon Hayward looking pretty good. 6 of 11 from the field, 5 assists. He is definitely the best passer among the ball handlers. Horford led the team with 8 assists. Irving also had 7. I mean, the Celtics sprayed it around to the tune of 30 assists on 41 field goals. Although you're going to have more assists too when you never get to the foul line, because you just have more chances for an assist there. And so I thought Hayward looked pretty good. I mean, we didn't see, again, you know, a ton of drives from him, but the three ball is going down. At least his jumper doesn't look like wonky the way it did, you know, in that first game of the season. So yeah, I'm starting to have more faith that he's going to get there. And he also had a moment where he went up for kind of this sprawling block, got undercut a little bit, landed awkwardly on that left leg. He said or I don't know if it was to Tim, but might have just been in the presser after the game, but Tim wrote about it in the story that, you know, he felt some pain there, but you know, he was able to get up, and you could see almost the relief on his face as he like felt some pain, and then he looked down at that ankle and he knew it was okay. So that was good for him. It's still going to be some steps for him, but I think especially against going against this team, he's being guarded by Brogdon at the beginning, and I think he can kill Brogdon, you know, if they choose to go at that matchup.
Most importantly for me, this was the best Hayward has looked physically. You know, there were other games where he showed his skill level, and also he had some beautiful passes in this game. Like there was one, the first play of the third quarter, where he drove in. It was another one of those like one step inside the 3-point line, somebody over helps, and then he just drilled it right to Kyrie in the corner. And those passes are tough because not only do you need to get it at the right spot, like so that the guy can shoot quickly, but getting the velocity correct is extremely important as well, because if it's too slow, Marcus Smart every once in a while throws the right pass too slowly, and then that gives the defense time to recover. It's all these different elements that need to be the right. But if you're asking for other things we need to talk about from this game, and Celtics fans should put on some earmuffs for this, Jason Tatum shot selection and his overall execution offensively was very concerning for me in this one. He had some tough matchups. I mean, Milwaukee has a lot of guys with length, but he is far too comfortable taking bad shots unless he becomes a much better bad shot maker, because basically nobody in the league, there are like five guys that are so good at making bad shots that it's worth it for them to think, okay, this is worth doing right
now. Well, and he could become one of those guys, but this isn't last year.
Sure.
You know, and the
Celtics have offensive talent. They don't need to rely on something like that. They were getting good shots whenever they tried.
Yeah. So this year, Tatum, 44 out of 108, shooting 41% overall from the field. 10 out of 31 from three. That's going to get better. But only 23 shots at the rim all year, and he's taken 43 mid-rangers and has made 14 of them. That's not good. And again, this is a team that has a chance to get threes. You know, I think he likes that mid-ranger. I was very impressed with him early last year when he went into more of a spot-up mode. He's a very good spot-up three-point shooter, but he's not as good as Gordon Hayward is going to be, I think, when Hayward can get back to being himself. You know, people were talking about him maybe being the best player in the Celtics. That is not true. But he's 20. That's fine. You know, and I think, like I said about Donovan Mitchell and maybe even Ben Simmons, the idea that Jason Tatum was going to take a leap to be like a top 20 player in the NBA this year, you know, probably wasn't ever realistic. People just want to assume that you're going to make this big leap, and you know, progress is generally more incremental than that. But, you know, I would like to see some better shot selection from him. But, you know, especially in a game like this where the Bucks were helping so much, you know, they went to him a lot trying to create shots in the first half. And then really when they went away from that in the second half, getting some guys who are better passers, like Tatum can pass, but he doesn't think that first. You know, I think that's why I would say that Hayward is a better guy there. But other than shooting corner threes, like Tatum needs to find a way to be productive without taking long twos off the dribble in this offense.
Along those same lines, there were some moments in this game when Boston had Irving and Hayward off the floor in particular, where they weren't getting those good shots, even against the Bucks were still doing some of those things. And so I'm not sure yet what Terry Rozier's place, and I'm not saying this as a criticism.
Yeah, another guy who took sure, some bad long twos in this game.
Took some bad twos. It's just, can Terry Rozier be the key offensive player on a team that reliably gets good shots? And remember, he's doing a lot of it right now that Kyrie's back. He plays with Kyrie too, but a lot of the time when Rozier has that onus on him, he's playing with backups against backups, and he's not getting those great looks for himself and teammates as much as you would like for somebody that you're then extrapolating, this guy is going to be able to do it as a starter. And something that you and I will talk about later in this episode is guys that have a lot of money on the line. And while I am not every general manager, I'm not even a single general manager, if I were trying to guess how a player is going to work in those sorts of circumstances, that's something I'd be looking at closely, is when they have a talent advantage, when they're playing, you know, because Boston's bench is better than damn near everybody else's bench. Maybe not offensively, but overall, like, what are they getting? What shots is he getting? What shots are his teammates getting? And I'm not sold on that yet. And that wasn't the reason why Boston made it to the conference finals last year. Yes, Rozier was an important part of that, but it wasn't because they were just getting great shots and killing it. It was a lot of defensive grinds and all that sort of thing. And there are other players that can lead you there if that's what you're looking for.
Yeah, we already said how maybe it's time for Tatum to take a little bit of a step down in the pecking order. Well, that's even more true for Rozier. He needs to get in line behind Tatum, and they're playing Tatum on some of these second units with Rozier. And Just to give you an idea, like Rozier is obviously pressing. He was looking to score long twos. And frankly, you know, if he presses, that's the shot that he's going to get a lot of times. So he's taken 9 shots at the rim this year, and he's taken 29 twos outside the restricted area. He's shooting 37% on two-pointers. And, you know, his three-pointer is fine again, but, you know, he's only taken 24 three-pointers. So, yeah, his shot selection as well just hasn't been great. They don't have an unbelievable offensive second unit, but, you know, when he's taking these shots off the dribble early in the clock, that's not necessarily what you're looking for. But, I mean, my overall impression, before I want to talk a little bit about the end of the game here, maybe not the greatest detail in the world, because we've been talking for 29 minutes about this game, which is fascinating. I mean, I love talking about these two teams. And again, like, I don't want to, like, all these Bucks fans to be totally depressed. I mean, they've made great strides. They easily could have won this game with better shooting. You know, I'm just a little worried about the strategy. But I think home court advantage, if these two teams match up, is going to be very, very important. I mean, we have seen the Bucks again just cannot win in Boston. It seems like in Boston, you know, did not win in Milwaukee either. So, you know, and I think it's realistic to talk about the Bucks as being up there record wise, you know, with the Celtics and the Raptors. And, you know, for all the hand wringing about the Celtics, they're still 6-2, you know, and they've beaten some pretty good teams, albeit at home. Let's just talk a little bit about the end of the game. We don't have to go possession by possession, but quack.
I mean, so the Bucks got back into this game because of a series of big Chris Milton shots. He made 3 threes in about a minute and a half that helped cut the margin from 8 to 4, because Boston made some shots in there as well. And then it gets all the way down and Brogdon makes a layup. So then it sticks for a while, actually, at 113-111. And
yeah, that's when the Celtics missed 4 wide open 3-pointers in a row.
Yes. And there were some great hustle offensive rebounds there. There were some good fortune offensive
Kyrie
rebounds
had
there,
a great stop on Middleton in the post.
Yeah, he did. He really did. Yeah, and Middleton, yeah, it was one of the plays where you kind of thought there was a foul because Middleton went to the ground. But what happened was Kyrie got his hand on the ball. And when Middleton tried to recover it, he just lost him. He just lost a little bit. Maybe he tried to accentuate the contact a little bit. But yeah, then so that was with, I think, 51 seconds to go. So then Boston had a chance to basically knock him out. Horford missed what I recall as being a pretty decent look at a three. I don't remember that shot. And then, so then you're sitting there going, okay, Milwaukee gets the ball, 25 seconds to go, down only 2 points at this point. And so you're like, okay, they're gonna have a pretty good shot at this. And they did have a pretty good shot at it, but then things went a little haywire.
Yeah, and while we did criticize Bud's coaching going for the quack two twice at the end of the game, some things that were good, not taking the timeout. When they got the rebound with 25 seconds left, they pushed it up. Giannis was able to attack on the baseline, got a great look past Horford, and just tried to go for the lefty reverse layup on the right side, which was the right play. But just, yeah, that could be kind of a tricky shot sometimes. He shot it too far over the backboard. So they have to take a foul, but they weren't in the bonus. And then Bucks did an awesome job of, when they got the ball into Tatum near half court, but in the backcourt, just trapping him. He threw it away. Bledsoe made a great play. And then Tatum had to foul him as he could have been turning the corner to go in for a layup. But of course, Bledsoe in his personal house of horrors, Boston, missing the first free throw out of two. I thought maybe they could have intentionally missed it at that point, but they still had some timeouts. So Bledsoe makes the second free throw. Then they had to foul Kyrie. He hits two and they're down three. They don't take a timeout. They still have two timeouts left with 12.3 remaining. And they wasted 6 of those seconds for Eric Bledsoe to go the full length of the court. Never even thought about taking a three. I thought he actually could have pulled up. Just went right to the rim. And the whole problem with the quack two is it's not automatic. And so Bledsoe misses a pretty tough shot, you know, probably a 50%, 45% type of shot, you know, where he had to stop on a dime and turn back. Bucks get the rebound with 5 seconds left. And then they go try to just throw it into Giannis for the quick two. And then he gets fouled and he only makes one. So you had two chances at the quick two. You're basically scoring only 1 point. That shows you exactly why. And also with Giannis missing that second free throw, I thought Bud missed a chance to put his rebounders in and really try to get that offensive rebound, because there was no guarantee that Giannis was going to make that second free throw. So to try and at least get the offensive rebound, they didn't really compete there. Stevens put in Baines and Horford. And they were able to corral the rebound, and Horford made two free throws, and the game was over.
Yeah, so there were some good and some bad there. I mean, the good going for the trap quickly, you know, so enough time to foul, and they forced a mistake. But, I mean, your chances of the goal is to win the game. As Herm Edwards once said, you play to win the game. And when you have the ball with 12 seconds to go, and you're down by 3 points, especially when you have to when you choose to dribble the ball all the way up the freaking court, your chances of winning the game are substantially higher if you take that three versus if you go for two.
And another reason to do that too is that that's early enough that they might not be able to feel it. They feel like they may not be able to foul, right? If you score a two and then they just hit two free throws on the other end, now there's enough time left where they could foul potentially as well. So you're taking yourself out. You're opening that up as a strategy the later it gets.
Right. And I mean, Boston didn't really have to do that. And we had talked about the idea of kind of how Boston could approach that when they were basically up three with just a few seconds to go. And I mean, then eventually when they were up four with just a few seconds to go, and Milwaukee just made it too easy for them. And I mean, I still think that Boston would have won the game. Like, that's the more likely outcome, but it's playing the odds, you know, like that's really what you're trying to do. And none of the solutions are perfect. You know, it's not like you're going to be getting a deep three from one of the best shooters alive or something like that. If Milwaukee had that guy, their offense would look very different, but it's super hard to win scoring a two at that point, just because especially, oh, this is the other point I wanted to bring up with going for a quick two with 5 seconds to go. You can't trap at that point. You can force a turnover on a 5 second call, or maybe they just screw up the inbound. But once they have the ball into a guy, you have to foul. You can't really do anything too cute, because they can just hold the ball and they're fine. And so you lose a lot of those benefits as well by burning the time and going for the two.
Yeah. I mean, it's one thing if you try to get a three, it's not there. You just don't even have a good look at a three and someone's wide open under the basket, or you can just drive in and shoot an uncontested layup. But that obviously was not the case here. If you want to read about this game, The Athletic is a great place to do it. Jay King on the Celtics, Eric Nem on the Bucks, and another great Athletic article, John Krasinski, Shams. Like, every time they write about the Jimmy Butler situation, you always have a new nugget that wasn't available. Joe Varden, great reporting on the Cavs situation. He reported shortly before Lou was fired the fact that the Cavs vets had been told, okay, first we're going to compete, and now, oh no, you're not going to play, and then, oh no, actually, after we lost to Atlanta, you are going to play again, and that kind of presaged everything that was going on. And Jason Lloyd also had some good nuggets about the Lou firing, and our pal Dan Gilbert in Cleveland. The Athletic is just doing awesome work, and if you don't know exactly what they are, no ads, no pop-ups, no autoplay videos. They have easily, I think, the best team of writers covering the NBA at this point. Danny does the vast majority of his writing for The Athletic at this point. So you can be a part of the future of sports journalism. There's a reason why they just closed this huge round of funding as well, $40 million in funding. Go to theathletic.com/capspace to get 40% off your first year of subscription. Let them know what that /capspace URL that you came from us. All right, we got a little bit of news to get to here. Actually, you know what? Now let's...
Oh, actually, I want to make a proposal. Oh, yeah. I have an idea of how I want to do this. I think even though, because we were so focused on this game because of the NBA cast, let's do a quick run around the league of the games that we didn't watch because we were watching this game, because I thought this was a pretty fascinating night from what I could tell from the things that we didn't see. And I want to start in Atlanta because De'Aaron Fox had the best game of his still young NBA career. 31, 15 assists and 10 rebounds as they just beat the ever-loving pants off the Atlanta Hawks in the second half of this game. It was pretty close at halftime, but then 46-23 in the third quarter. So now the Sacramento Kings are 6-3, and that's another wonderful story. We talked about them a lot on yesterday's Dunked On, but I wanted to add that little coda to this part of the story.
The Hawks defense is atrocious. Play your daily fantasy guys against them, DraftKings.com, with the cap space code. Portland took care of New Orleans without Anthony Davis. We talked about that game. I don't think we did actually talk about that game last
night.
We did not. We were supposed to talk more about it. I don't really have a ton of observations. Yeah, we're supposed to do this maybe we'll just save that money on the line thing for later, because we actually have a lot to talk about. There's still some news too. Let's talk about that game yesterday. Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
I have a couple of things on it. So I think first of all, Anthony Davis didn't look right to me all the way physically. You know, he was on the floor. It was certainly nice that he was out there, but he's still an awesome player, even if he's not 100%. And so for me, one of the most important takeaways from that game was that Draymond Green was very active defensively, and I thought he made a big difference in the game. And also Nikola Mirotic. I just really like his fit with Davis, because when you have Mirotic next to Davis and Drew Holiday, no matter what, he's the third option or deeper down the rotation. But then if he's hot, those guys are both capable players to feed him and to accentuate what Mirotic does well. He ended the game with 26 and 12. So I really like that fit. And then while Randall did not go off like he did in the first half of the game against Portland, where he scored 23 in the first half and then tailed off a little bit there due to foul trouble and everything else, he's just a force. Like, Randall, such a hard guy to counter, because what he does, nobody else can really handle it, because he's stronger than a lot of those players, plays with a lot of intention, and I'm super excited to see him in games with real stakes.
Yeah, I didn't think he played well against the Warriors. I thought that he might be someone who could cause them problems, but they didn't really like try to get him the ball on the perimeter and let him attack. I do want to see these teams match up when Davis is looking a little healthier. Certainly on offense, he was not the force. He only had 17 points. And he usually plays pretty well. He did have 7 assists, though. He really has been distributing far more than he has in past years, as we talked about yesterday. But you know, he played 41 minutes. Holiday played 42. Moore played 39. I don't think they have an answer for Steph Curry. And the Warriors didn't even have to go to Kevin Durant at all posting up either, like, which, of course, just completely eviscerated the Pels in the playoffs last year.
Well, and that gets into something that I just find so interesting when these two teams go at it. And remember, Alvin Gentry is a former Warriors assistant. He was an assistant on the first title team of this era. And he chooses consistently to have Drew Holiday, his base assignment is on Kevin Durant. And I mean, they don't really have anybody to guard either Durant or Curry other than Drew. But it's just such an interesting choice, because Curry, like, Drew Holiday is one of, in my opinion, the best defenders on Curry in the entire league. But if you put somebody who can't defend Kevin Durant on Durant, then he can just live there too. And so maybe they think they can scheme and execute a little bit better with Steph than they can with KD, who's just so comfortable isolating on inferior defense.
Yeah, well, Steph, you know, goes off around screens so much that it kind of doesn't matter as much who is on him. And Steph was just unbelievable again. 37 points, 7 of 11 from 3. I mean, he's clearly to me the MVP in the early going at 9 assists as well. But I mean, my overall takeaway was just, I don't see a path here for the Pels. And that's not a surprise, you know, and we'll see, you know, they look great in the early going. We'll see what it looks like when Davis is a little healthier. They lost again tonight to Portland with Davis out. And, you know, the fact that he was out with that sprained elbow after playing in this one, he clearly didn't look quite as comfortable shooting the ball. I think it was more he just wasn't quite as physical mixing it up, especially offensively. And Elfrid Payton missed this one too. I don't think, you know, unless he can really shoot the ball better, I think he's an upgrade on Rondo, but you know, he's still probably going to get guarded by Draymond Green and it will provide some help. But you know, Draymond and KD said this after the game. It was KD actually, that you know, if all the games are going to be, you know, 131-121, the Warriors aren't going to lose that type of game, right? I mean, you really have to defend first to stop these guys and kind of muck things up, because you know, the Warriors, they may not stop everyone amazing well, but they have guys who can get out there and make stops in key situations. And then, you know, if you're just running up and down the floor, you're going to have these possessions where Steph Curry is going to just get wide open, or Klay Thompson is going to get wide open, and KD is going to get wide open. Those guys are just going to knock down shots better than your guys, even if they, you know, you'll take the Warriors wide open shots against anybody else. So I wasn't feeling great about the Pels' chances, but their deep bench, not so good either. I mean, they had to play Ian Clark, they had to play Frank Jackson, Solomon Hill didn't look very good. I mean, those are guys 7 through 9 off the bench there. Tim Frazier had to start. So they're still really thin. Darius Miller also missed this one, but he's not going to make the difference against Golden State either. So yeah, big surprise. We don't think that the Pels can keep up with Golden State. But when you're looking for these early season games, like, oh, is there some hope? You know, didn't really appear to be a ton of hope for me with the Pels.
Also, for selfish reasons, because it was fortuitous timing, I had already submitted a piece to be published on Thursday about Jonas Repko and Alphonso McKinney and their place in the Warriors rotation. And both those guys, I thought, did pretty well. You know, not their best games. McKinney was awesome against the Bulls when Klay Thompson set the 3-point record. And basically the goal for those two players, and this is basically the thesis of the piece, is just to be competent, functional pieces that don't really take much away from this team. And ideally, yeah, it'd be great if one of those two could get reliable playoff minutes, but that's not the goal for right now. And we both espouse concerns about the Warriors' depth, you know, especially with Iguodala taking it so easy. And I mean, Livingston's missed a bunch of time now in the regular season. And getting two competent players who try hard, who don't screw up very often, is really important. I thought they needed guards more than forwards, but they can make it work either way.
Getting back to your initial premise here, OKC winning in Charlotte at 111-107, that was big for them. And OKC now three straight wins for them. They're healthy again, 3-4, right back into where they need to be. And I was never that worried about them because it really was only a two-game losing streak. Despite some of the concerns we detailed about their offense yesterday, but they had lost four straight, but two of those were without Westbrook. And then Charlotte loses another close game, big surprise. Philly beat the Clippers 122-113 at home. Joel Embiid 41 points, 32 field goal attempts, and Markelle Fultz actually was plus 16. He had a big stretch early in the third, although he did not close the game. Where he played pretty well, had 12 points, but was pushing the ball, and people were watching or saying that was a spark. And then Denver takes care of Cleveland on the road, 110-91. The Hawks' honeymoon is over for Cleveland. They fall to 1-7.
I got a little bit excited early on in that game. Cleveland was up, I think it was something like 12-2, and I thought maybe the voice was really leading the Cavs to a much larger thing, but then eventually things go back.
Oh, Danny, also, Danny, you know who had a good game? We better seize on these when we can. The apple of our eye. The leading scorer for the Nuggets.
Juancho.
Yes. 23 points.
Yeah, Juancho Hernan. And okay, well, this can be a transition news or just a point here. If the Nuggets do not think that Tyler Lydon is good enough to play minutes in a game that is basically that the end of the game is functionally garbage time, cut him. Putting in somebody else, sign, even if it's to a non-guaranteed contract, somebody who you think has a greater chance of actually being a functional player on this team.
Yeah, or someone who you can get to a non-guaranteed second year, because now Lydon's option was declined. And that can take us into some news here right after this from a new sponsor. Roofstock.com, which allows you to buy, sell, and own investment properties the way pro investors do. You can start earning passive income right away. Everyone knows real estate's a great way to build personal wealth and diversify your investment, but it can be complicated. With Roofstock, you can invest in single-family homes across the country with as little as $20,000 down. They've made the whole process transparent and easy to engage. You can view inspection reports, take a 3D tour, see neighborhood ratings, and when you find a property you like, you add it to your cart. They even offer a 30-day money-back guarantee. If your vacant rental property doesn't have a tenant after 45 days from closing, Roofstock will pay your projected rental income for up to a year. This month only, they've got a special deal for Dunktown listeners, $500 credit towards your Roofstock marketplace fee at roofstock.com/capspace. Easy to remember, /capspace, talk about all the time here on the program, although not quite as much during this time of year before trade season gets going. That's roofstock.com/capspace for a $500 credit this month only. roofstock.com/capspace. I'll note that /capspace URL that you came from us. It's an interesting concept. So let's talk a little news here. We can start in Cleveland. Kevin Love, the news on his health is not amazing. He confirmed on Tuesday he's going to miss several weeks with that big toe injury. It's bothered him since the preseason. It got so severe he even had trouble walking. And he did not rule out surgery, although he had an MRI. He visited Dr. Martin O'Malley at the hospitals for special surgery in New York, and he's been told to rest it. No timetable really for when he's going to play again. And this could be one of those tricky ones, right? Where it's just kind of swelling up. You don't really know why. He doesn't even know when he injured it. And so, okay, you rest it for a while, maybe do a little rehab, you come back, try to ramp up your activity, and you just don't know when you ramp up your activity, is it going to start to swell again? But nothing really came up on the MRI, so hopefully some rest will do him good, but he rested plenty during training camp, and it was insufficient. And by the time he gets back, let's just say there won't be a ton of reason to rush him back. But, people have acknowledged they signed him to this deal to potentially that big extension, 4 years, $120 million, to potentially trade him. So they probably will want him to at least get back and playing well before trade season gets underway.
It will definitely be worth watching how that works. And related Cavs news, there was this scuttlebutt is the word I'll use for J.R. Smith. He was basically asked during media availability if he wanted to be traded, and he said yes. And so then there was this discussion about whether he would get fined for that being a trade demand. I believe the most recent thing I saw from Woj was that he will not be, which I firmly agree with. I think that a trade demand is something very different from somebody asking you, do you want to be traded, and you saying yes.
Yeah, and then and also, say you want to be traded is different from trade me or else I won't play. You know, that's not a demand. It's just, but now, now
it's, it's not even a request. It's just an expression of hope, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, now we could see some people try to fudge on this of like to their favorite reporter, hey, you might want to ask me if I want to be traded tonight. You know, like you could see that sort of thing happening, but.
Or you could get some reporters from the Players Tribune. That would be a really awesome way to do that.
Yeah.
But yeah. And on related news, the Cavs are exploring Kyle Korver trades. For me, the real challenge here is finding somebody who just really wants Korver at his current price, because he could potentially be bought out at some point. Or if the Cavs are willing to take on either in a J.R. Smith trade, a Kyle Korver trade, or both, take on a larger guaranteed portion for a subsequent season. Because while it is true J.R. Smith was signed under the prior CBA, which means he still has that special calculation where they could trade him and he would count at his full value, but then the other team wouldn't have to pay that full value. They'd only have to pay the light partial guarantee. Korver does not, because he signed under the current CBA. But you could also just trade those guys now and it functionally works the same. Like you could trade J.R. Smith right now for a matching player who just has guaranteed money for next year. So they don't have to wait until June or July or whenever to make those moves. They can, but it's just how much surplus value are they providing?
Yeah, and Cleveland does not project to have a ton of cap space next year, regardless of whether they move on from Smith or Korver. Now, I mean, really, I think the only way those guys have substantial value is if Cleveland is willing to take on bad money that goes another year in terms of salary matching for them. And George Hill is in a very similar situation as well, with only $1 million guaranteed next year out of his $20 million or so. So we'll see. I mean, Cleveland, they're going to have to start hitting the reset button pretty soon here. You know, I mean, if I would love to go through their schedule, but, you know, if they have more than 5 wins at the end of November, that would be a surprise to me. So they'll clearly be out of it at that point. Colin Sexton, he'll probably get all he can eat. And we'll see. I mean, Korver, you know, it's been talked about, oh, maybe they could get a second round pick for him. But then what's the matching salary becomes the question. Is it someone who's also expiring this year? You know, I mean, could it be to the Lakers for like Michael Beasley and, you know, enough filler that they could get back Korver? Or, you know, Philly for Jared Bayless might be an interesting one. And so then it'll just be the question of compensation. But certainly if they can get any kind of positive value for him, they might as well do it, especially because telling him he wasn't going to play it all for them anyways. You might as well. And if you can get off of that money for next year, I mean, I think that's probably the $3 million for next year. Like, that's what might give Philly some pause, for example. Like, they're just shy of a max salary slot as it projects right now with the Furkan Korkmaz option decline. We can get to that now.
Sure. Actually, briefly before we get there, I looked up Cleveland's schedule. I think we can wait to go in depth, maybe on the 15 and 60. I'll just say it's inhospitable overall.
Yeah.
There are some winnable games, but it is not super friendly to them.
They've had a home-heavy schedule so far.
They have. So Philly declined the option on Korkmaz. This was one that you and I both, from what I recall, said that we would pick up. And for me, it was the opportunity cost argument. Basically, $2 million is not going to be hard to move in case Korkmaz isn't impressive. And maybe there'd be somebody interested in him. But they have more info. And I always, you know, like, he's intriguing offensively, but his defensive limitations were always concerning to me. So it was on the margin. And now that clears $2 million in space as they pursue presumably a max player or some sort of amalgam of different guys in free agency next summer.
Yeah, and for Korkmaz, I mean, you'll recall he was drafted in 2016 along with Timothy Luau-Cabarro, and he waited a year to come over, I think more due to buyout reasons, but that's part of why I think he was selected too, because they really were in a roster crunch for these last few years. And so now, you know, I think he's someone who has some value and he'll be unrestricted. It would be worth taking a flyer on, you know, kind of along the lines of like a Nick Stauskas, who's actually given Portland some production this year. And another great Athletic piece, by the way, at theathletic.com/capspace, Derek Bodner wrote about how Philly, despite the fact that they've had these great stars develop in Simmons and Embiid, came in having all these assets 2 years ago and really have kind of lost a lot of them without a ton of return. And Korkmaz, TLC, Pasechniks, I mean, those are three picks in the 20s. I mean, you don't necessarily expect to get something out of those, but it would have been nice if one of those guys hit, and they basically have nothing for those guys right now.
Cheap rotation players are incredibly valuable, and Philly's dealing with depth issues. Like, that's something they've gone through the last couple of years, and even somebody who projects as eventually being a depth player would be really useful for them. Another option that I decline, that I accepted, I would have accepted that was declined, is Malachi Richardson. Same basic logic. The difference being that Toronto's cap space is much more nebulous. We don't know if Kawhi's coming back. We don't know if Danny Green's coming back, all these other things. And there's also the news that Kawhi Leonard is still not playing in back-to-backs. And I'm totally on board with that. We don't know exactly how it's going to affect seeding. You know, they did get their butts kicked by the Bucks without him out there, but it's the long game. I mean, we can already tell that with Toronto, that if they're healthy, they're going to be in this into May. And if that's the case, why put extra miles on a guy who's recovering from this strange malady?
Yeah, Leonard, I wouldn't play him in a single back-to-back all season. Why bother, right? I mean, and we've talked about how strange it is and how this is really kind of a chronic injury, an overuse type of injury. Why even begin to expose him to something where that could come back when, again, as you mentioned, it was so nebulous last year? And, you know, he's playing really well. He was going through these workouts. He remains a mystery of, you know, how much maybe he could have actually played last year or not. But he was able to get back, and he's looking good this year. So, I mean, to me, you know, maybe if you get down the end of the year and it's like, okay, we have this one back-to-back and that's going to win, you know, and we're playing Boston on the second end and we played Milwaukee on the front end, and like we needed him in both these games to get the one seed. All right, maybe you think about it. And then going back to Richardson, I would have declined the option. He did show a little something in summer league, but they got big tax concerns next year. And this is another one too, where he's going to be on the team. He's not really going to play at all this year. So you could potentially re-sign him if you really, I don't see anyone else offering him like guaranteed money at the end of this year. If you really like him, you could always maybe try to bring him back. What else we got here?
Another option, we talked about the Celtics a lot already, but Danny Ainge picked up Gershon Yabusele's option. I think of Yabusele as a guy who has more backside than upside, but...
See, I laugh at your jokes when they're funny. You're just like a brick wall.
Well, I'm muted most of the time. And well, you are like muted on,
for my awesome Seinfeld reference on the NBA cast today.
I mean, I didn't think it was as impressive. It was teed up.
That's all right.
But it was still.
I interrupt you as I just did this very moment, and you don't laugh at my jokes. It's our thing. It's fine.
It's our chemistry. But so Yabusele, maybe there's a larger plan going on. Also, Danny Ainge has earned the benefit of the doubt. I've been critical of some of his moves that have really worked out. I don't see an NBA player, at least in the near term, in there, but you still have that opportunity. Doesn't cost a ton of money. And a point that you brought up on the NBA cast was that he could end up being useful salary filler. And we don't know exactly where Boston's offseason is going. So that's an option too, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, that's really the only upside to it that I can see. I mean, they also have like plenty of guys at his position. And I mean, the idea that you couldn't get someone better than him for the minimum is surprising. And it's going to make him so much harder to trade now, you would think, if they want to move him to try to get under the tax. Dirk Nowitzki in a video yesterday saying that he is still weeks away from returning. Does not look particularly mobile when we've seen some of these videos of him shooting around. And then Memphis cut someone who, I guess it's not surprising at this point, but Andrew Harrison, who's played well for them at times, is no longer a Memphis Grizzly.
I thought this was coming at some point when they signed Shelvin Mack, and Shelvin Mack is a more proven commodity. He's had some nice performances for Memphis as well. He played with Conley a little bit and played without him, to be sure. And Harrison, Bobby Marks laid in part of the timeline here was that his protection was going to increase every day by about $8,500 starting on November 5th. So they will take a $200,000 cap hit, which I think is kind of covered by his salary so far, you know, like that sort of a thing. And they haven't made a corresponding roster move yet, but they can do that at basically any point that is convenient for them. And so I think Harrison is somebody that can help a few of these point guard needy teams. You know, he's not a perfect option to be sure, but I mean, when you're looking at Orlando or Chicago and Phoenix, just having somebody else that you can try is worth it. And Harrison has done more than a lot of the other players that they would probably consider.
Yeah, he's at least a solid defensive player. Doesn't do anything offensively inside the arc, but you know, his three-pointer was evolving. He was a little more aggressive taking them last year, but I think they just liked their number 32 overall pick, Javon Carter, a little better than him. Shelvin Mack has played well. They've got Conley, so I think they felt like it was almost more doing him a favor maybe to release him at this point, but I do expect him to glom on elsewhere. in Utah, Donovan Mitchell had to leave that crazy 50-point game, which we should probably actually discuss a little bit, that Derrick Rose had last night with hamstring tightness in the last 5 minutes. An MRI was negative. I'm not sure how an MRI could be negative, I guess, for like any kind of a significant tear, but he will not play Friday against the Grizz. So maybe Utah looking at another loss to the Grizz. And in Washington, Dwight Howard plans to make his season debut Friday against Oklahoma City. I would not want to be making my season debut with a back/glute injury against Steven Adams. That's a lot of leaning. And he said it's still difficult for him to sit down with that piriformis injury, which is a muscle in the glute. That's not great. You know, if he's not even that healed and he's just, you know, is he going to take like a painkilling injection to play? And Dwight, I mean, we've seen how much his performance can fluctuate. Just a small prediction here that I don't think he'll be a panacea for the Wizards' woes.
A calibrator that, if I remember, we can put this in the 15 and 60 sheet, would be a status report on how we feel about Dwight Howard's likelihood of picking up his player option. And we're not there yet. I haven't seen him play yet, but I think that might be an interesting
you might pick up that player option. It's due.
Going to the voice already. Wow.
Yeah, I mean, the center market, there's so many centers next year and so few teams need them. And yeah, I mean, it seems pretty unlikely to me. And you know, I'm sure he's gonna really fit in so well in that Washington locker room that the reports there will be glowing for him. Yeah.
Well, I mean, their locker room is so toxic it's glowing, so I guess that kind of makes sense.
Man, you're on fire today. Anything else we got to talk about here, or is that it?
Nothing else in terms of news. One thing I want to promote is that at some point on Friday, my Real GM Radio podcast will come out with Dan Feldman, friend of this program as well, the creator of Bucks here, as we didn't actually talk about Milwaukee too much on the show. But yeah, we got into a lot of different stuff. We talked a little bit about the rookie scale options, but takeaways from the season so far and what we're looking forward to the next couple weeks, all that kind of stuff.
All right. Thanks for listening. We'll be back 15 and 60 style, and we will get to eventually those which players have the most money on the line. Because I think that's actually a really interesting topic. I think that was suggested by a commenter on the now defunct Twitter NBA show. Am I remembering that correctly? Or no? Oh, did Ben Dell? Ben Dell came up with that, right?
No, I think somebody asked it to us. I said that's a good podcast topic, and then Ben wrote it down and sent it to us.
All right. Okay. Yeah. There we go.
But thank you, Ben.
All right. We will talk to you all on Sunday night. Till then.